I heard someone say today that, you know, the one good thing about a splash is that it surprises a lot of people, but the bad thing about a splash is it could be a belly flop.
Governor Palin prepares for her big speech. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 3rd of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, uncovering ancient village sites in the Aleutians.
You could walk right out of the houses, down to the beach, and basically be at the grocery store.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Governor Sarah Palin is preparing to accept the GOP vice presidential nomination at the party's convention tonight in St. Paul, Minnesota. Palin spent about 10 minutes this morning getting a run-through at the arena to discuss the setup for her speech. Tom Scheck is covering the convention for Minnesota Public Radio. He says Republican Party heavyweights like former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney and former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge have spent the day defending Palin's experience.
They feel like she's getting kind of a bad rap in the national press, so to speak. They feel like they're targeting her credentials unfairly. So they pretty much have been talking up her credentials, saying, you know, she's a person who's going to wow the stage tonight, one of these candidates who's a real game changer, who's someone who's going to head to Washington and just change things, which is a big thing they talked about today. They're almost stealing Barack Obama's line of change, and the Republicans are using it themselves.
And Tom, are you hearing anything about what will be included in Palin's speech tonight?
Well, we got a couple of excerpts, which they typically do before a speech, and what they want you to do is kind of, they want the folks to talk about them as they lead up to the news. And two of the excerpts that they talked about is she really is defending her credentials. One of the quotes is, I guess a small town mayor is sort of like a community organizer, except that you have actual responsibilities. That's a clear shot at Barack Obama, and I can imagine the delegates are going to rise to their feet because a lot of discussion has been on Barack Obama and whether he's qualified if he's qualified to be president during his term as a community organizer. The other thing is that she is pushing back on the what, you know, everyone's kind of saying is a media criticism on Sarah Palin, and she, you know, said, if you're not a member in good standing of the Washington elite, then some in the media consider a candidate unqualified for that reason alone. And she says, I'm not going to Washington to seek good opinion. She's going to serve the voters. So it's one of these things where she's saying she's not really concerned about this criticism or these questions and these stories that they're surfacing about her credentials and her experience. It's more about that she's going there to serve the people.
What do you think Palin needs to accomplish tonight with this speech?
Well, I heard someone say today that, you know, the one good thing about a splash is that it surprises a lot of people, but the bad thing about a splash is it could be a belly flop. So this is going to be the first time that the Alaska governor is going to have the national stage to herself. She was introduced on Friday, but for the most part, the American public didn't see her. What they did see were audio clips, or they've seen video clips of her, you know, kind of talking around things. This is the first time she's going to be on the national stage without anyone around her, and she's going to have to speak about who she is, what are her issues that are important to her, and her experience. There's going to be a lot of people watching, and it doesn't so much matter what people are doing in the arena tonight, because those people will walk through fire for her. They love her. They're going to back her, especially since there's been all this criticism, so-called criticism from the media. What is going to matter is what the folks in home through the TV sets, what those folks are going to be thinking, because those are the ones who are most impressionable. They have no idea who this person is.
And we've certainly heard a lot in the national press about how the delegates, as you said, are rallying behind Palin. Have you seen anything there today that really indicates that this will be stepped up somehow?
Well, I don't think the delegates could get any more excited than they are right now. They've kind of walked in here, and they're pretty excited about the pick. Some of the folks weren't 100% behind John McCain. This pick has kind of pushed them push them a little bit closer to them. But what they are trying to do is make sure that these folks go home with those talking points that I've been mentioning, and they kind of talk to their neighbors, those undecided voters, and they say, hey, this person is really a reform-minded candidate, or those types of things, those kind of talking points. You know, there's going to be a lot of phone calling, door knocking over the next 3 months, especially in swing states. And what they want these folks to do, these delegates, who are the ones who pretty much are the activists and work on behalf of the party, to go out there and talk up John McCain and Sarah Palin.
Tom Scheck is a reporter covering the convention for Minnesota Public Radio. Alaskans are gathering in a few different spots to watch the speech live tonight, including Tailgater's Sports Bar and Grill in Wasilla and McGinley's Pub in downtown Anchorage. The speech is expected at about 6:30 Alaska time. Rudy Giuliani will give the convention's keynote address tonight. The legislative investigation into the events leading up to the firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan is facing a setback. Senate Judiciary Chairman Hollis French had established a goal of issuing a report on the investigation by the end of October. When the committee's investigator began gathering facts, Governor Palin promised full cooperation from her administration. But French says some obstacles have come up since then.
Just yesterday evening, we learned that Frank Bailey was not going to appear for his deposition today. And of course, he's an important witness, and his attorney has said that until the jurisdictional issue gets straightened out, that his client would likely not be giving a statement.
Bailey is currently on paid administrative leave after a recording surfaced of a phone call he made to a state trooper in which Bailey pushed for the firing of Trooper Mike Wooten, the governor's former brother-in-law. In releasing the recording, the governor indicated that although Bailey gave the impression that he was speaking for her, she had not authorized the contact. His testimony is considered necessary to distance the governor from the perception that her administration had applied pressure to fire Wooten. The jurisdictional issue cited by Bailey's attorney is a challenge to the legislature's authority to conduct an investigation of the events. The governor has requested the investigation be done by the administration's own personnel board. French says the two investigations are not mutually exclusive.
We both have the right. There's absolutely nothing wrong if the governor wants to have the personnel board look into this matter. I think that's fine. But what you shouldn't confuse is their right to proceed with our right to proceed. The legislature is a separate and equal branch of government that has the inherent authority to conduct investigations. That goes all the way back to the founding fathers. That's just something that's built into our system of government.
French says at least one other person has backed away from voluntarily giving a statement, John Bitney, who used to be one of Palin's top staff members. Foreseeing a need for his input as well as Bailey's, French says he will meet this evening with members of the House to determine the schedule for issuing subpoenas and opening full investigative hearings. That is something French earlier said he had hoped to avoid. The state's largest teachers union has chosen a rural Alaska educator to lead their group for the first time. A veteran Bethel teacher has been chosen as the new president of NEA Alaska, the National Education Association of Alaska. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Barb Angayak has been an educator in the Yukon-Kuskokwim for over two decades. As NEA Alaska president, Angayak will represent 13,000 teachers and support staff statewide. Her teaching background runs deep in the YK Delta. She's originally from California, earned her degree in elementary education in Oregon, and then moved to the Nelson Island village of Nightmute along the Bering Sea coast, where she taught 9th through 12th grades. Later, she taught in Bethel for 19 years. The last 4 years, she has worked for the Lower Kuskokwim School District, mentoring new teachers in the villages, and as a grant writer. Chip Hagedorn, president of the Lower Kuskokwim Teachers Union, says Angayak will bring a different perspective to the table.
She's the first president from rural Alaska, so she knows the problems that are specific to rural Alaska, where our other presidents were certainly good presidents. They just didn't have firsthand knowledge of just the increased cost of education in rural Alaska and some of the problems that are specific to our area.
One of those problems is high dropout rates. According to the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage, Alaska has less freshmen graduate from high school than the national average. And Alaska Natives have the highest dropout rate of all ethnic groups in Alaska. And Guyack says one of the main reasons kids drop out is because the curriculum in schools do not match the students' interests and the community's needs. She says it's not appropriate to want all kids to go to college.
The better match we have with what we want kids to be able to know and do when they get out of school, the more likely we are to keep them in school. And so we've got to beef up what we're doing in career tech. We've got to give recognition to the skills that our kids have to live in a subsistence lifestyle, if that's what they choose. We need to be able to really say to kids, we are offering you something that you can actually use when you get out of school.
And Guyack says one of the biggest challenges in making education in Alaska better is the No Child Left Behind policy, which stresses accountability in education. Although she agrees that accountability is needed, and Guyack says the policy is not working.
The stringent nature of the guidelines has really hampered us being able to do a full job of educating an entire child. We now are so focused on test scores that we're really losing sight of the need for music and the arts and PE and a lot of the things that are really highlights when I think back in my own education.
And Guyack is on leave from the Lower Kuskokwim School District for the 2 years she will serve as the NEA president, which is a full-time position. She will be based out of Anchorage for the next 2 years. Her term ends July of 2010. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, surveying fish species in the Beaufort Sea.
I'd actually been telling people before I left that, oh, I seriously doubt we'll catch any pollock way up there, and we did catch some.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
People began populating the eastern Aleutians 9,000 years ago and continued heading west over the next 6 millennia. Remnants of their ancient and not-so-ancient village sites can still be seen in the Aleutians today if you know what to look for. KIAL's Ann Hillman has the story.
Scanning the meadow above the black obsidian beaches of Seaguam Island in the eastern Aleutians reveals a subtle change in the topography. The smooth flow of grasses turns slightly rough and bumpy. Walking through the chest-high vegetation reveals a large pit with smaller ones radiating to the side, an old Aleut house.
These were big communal houses, so there were several families in the house, and each family would have one or two of these side rooms off of their compartment in the house. And then you could have the kids sleeping in there, you could store things in there, and sometimes they buried people in those side rooms as well.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife archaeologist Deborah Corbett went to the site with her colleague Allison McLean to look for charcoal samples that can be used to date the structure. About 30 house pits range down the meadow at the Seaguam site, though Corbett says only 3 or 4 were occupied at a time. Between 20 and 30 people lived in each house, which were originally built with sod and driftwood or whalebones. Corbett says she thinks that the oldest pits go back 1,000 years, when an unexplained population boom in the region caused people to move from small, single-family homes to dwellings that could house up to 300 people.
In the eastern Aleutians, houses got much bigger and more complex, and we think that that reflects political and economic changes that were going on in the society because of the increase in the population.
They're situated near a creek on a flat area above a rock beach, where inhabitants had easy access to food-filled tide pools.
That you could walk right out of the houses, down to the beach, and basically be at the grocery store.
The site was so well situated that the military made use of it during World War II.
the military guys often put their own buildings inside these large pits because the pit was already there. It was protected. And it's smarter to put your pit inside someone else's pit than dig a whole fresh new one.
Sometimes this makes it difficult to distinguish between artifacts left by the Aleuts, who lived there until the war, and artifacts left by soldiers. At the Seaguam site, decaying telephone poles and metal barrels made the distinction more obvious. Corbett says, prehistoric and historic Aleut village sites exist on many of the islands, though they have not all been mapped. You can most easily find them in the spring, because plants tend to sprout there first.
People were bringing all kinds of stuff into the sites. They're bringing in vegetation, they're bringing in fish, blood, human waste, all this stuff in the sites. So the soil chemistry is different, and I think they're also better drained. So the vegetation just grows differently.
The bits of trash that help the plants grow also help archaeologists date the sites and learn about the people who lived there. In the Aleutians, I'm Ann Hillman.
The University of Alaska announced yesterday that the oil company Chevron is giving the university $1 million. KBBI's Mike Mason has the details.
$500,000 is being given to the university's Alaska Native Science and Engineering program, and the other $500,000 will go to the Kenai Peninsula College's Kenai River campus in Soldotna. Gary Turner is the director of the college.
It's the largest corporate donation the KPC has ever received. We're absolutely thrilled. I couldn't tell you how thrilled we are with this. And because of Chevron's donation, it's great. It's going to allow us to do things that we haven't been able to do before. Some of the things, you know, we're going to be upgrading some of our teaching labs within our process technology, instrumentation, and electronic computing labs. You know, there's a lot of industry standard training equipment that we have a good bit of it, but there's more that we need because we need to make sure that the students we train are being trained on what they will find when they get in the field. So some of the funds will be used for that. And also, we'll be looking to establish a scholarship program for students going through these courses and programs.
The $500,000 gift to the university will officially happen Thursday at the college's fall barbecue. The ceremony will feature representatives from Chevron, KPC, and UAA. Turner says he was blown away earlier this summer when he learned of the Chevron gift to the college.
When you're a small college like us, these types of gifts are typically not done very frequently. And as I said, it's been our 44-year history. It's the first time we've received a gift of this size. We would certainly hope and invite other large corporations to match Chevron's donation. That'd be even better. But we sincerely appreciate what Chevron's done. They are a true supporter of what we do here at KPC. We're putting Alaskans to work and Alaskan jobs.
Chevron has over 59,000 employees worldwide, and around 400 of them are in the state of Alaska. The company's been in Alaska for the past 50 years and currently produces around 34,000 barrels of oil a day from its Alaska facilities. Roxanne Sins is the public affairs manager for Chevron. She confirms that the $1 million is the largest gift the company has ever made in the state of Alaska.
The reason is to develop a trained workforce in Alaska, and it needs corporations to partner with the university to strengthen the educational programs and to develop a trained workforce in Alaska. And we need corporations to partner with the university to strengthen the educational programs. And Chevron believes in recruiting and training locally, and we want to be active within the community. And part of it is that Chevron recently began increasing our activity within the state, and we now have over 400 employees in Alaska.
The ceremony to accept the Chevron gift will happen in conjunction with the ribbon-cutting ceremony for the newly constructed Skywalk and renovated science labs at the Kenai River campus. Turner says the renovations at the college will make a big difference to both students and faculty.
The science labs have not been renovated since the McLean building was built in 1973. So you walk in and it's an upgraded, modern 2008 science labs.
The ribbon-cutting ceremony and the official acceptance of the $500,000 gift from Chevron are both open to the public, and they will happen in front of the Goodrich and McLean buildings on the Kenai River campus in Soldotna. In Homer, I'm Mike Mason.
High energy costs and concern about the upcoming winter are affecting enrollment at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Tim Barnett, Vice Chancellor for Student Enrollment Services at UAF, says overall student numbers are down slightly, and most of that seems to be in non-degree-seeking students who typically take a class or two to upgrade their employment status.
The information that we're getting at this point seems to be that some of those students are holding back, waiting to see what the fuel costs are going to be, energy costs just for living and driving to work. And we hope that we'll see some of those students go ahead and sign up as gas prices, or at least the price per barrel, seems to be dropping at this point.
Over 7,000 students are currently enrolled for fall classes at UAF and associated rural campuses. Barnett says enrollment seems to be picking up as next week's sign-up deadline approaches. He doesn't think this year's 7% tuition increase is contributing to the decline. UAF has seen an increase in first-time students this fall.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing personal attention from people who live and work right here in Alaska. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
An office set up in Fairbanks to provide information on state energy efficiency and assistance programs is getting heavy interest. The portal on retrofits, training, and loans was established to help people take advantage of the state-funded assistance. Portal program liaison Michael Berry says there's a backlog of people trying to take advantage of weatherization and rebate programs.
We've had hundreds of people over the course of the past couple months that we've been open here, and we're only anticipating those numbers to grow.
State legislators expanded Alaska's free home weatherization program earlier this year to reach more people and added an efficiency upgrade rebate program for higher income bracket homeowners. The first step in either program is a home energy evaluation. Heavy interest means some people will have to wait a year before that happens, but Barry says they're still eager to take advantage of the programs.
I think that we're starting to face kind of a crisis here in Fairbanks. We're going to have a whole new span of people that weren't previously concerned with staying warm this winter that now are. And it's definitely becoming more and more of a problem, and people are trying to remedy it as much as possible.
Barry says the portal is also seeing interest in loans from people who can't afford to make energy upgrades out of pocket. She says experts are also on hand answering questions and teaching classes on common retrofit strategies, alternative heating sources, and ways to save electricity. Fisheries biologists are back from a month-long trip to study fish species in the Beaufort Sea. They were looking at what types of fish inhabit the Beaufort and how plentiful they are. Global warming is already forcing more and more animals, including fish, north to the Arctic Ocean. The only previous survey of fish species in the area took place in the 1970s. Elizabeth Lagerwell was a lead scientist on the study. She says the work was funded by the Minerals Management Service.
They want a baseline against which to monitor the effects of future oil and gas development. And then we as fishery scientists we're just kind of interested in what's going on in the Beaufort Sea. In case there becomes interest in commercial fishing, we want a baseline. And we're also interested in a baseline for assessing the effects of climate change in the Arctic.
And I realize that you just got back, but have you had an opportunity to do any analysis yet of some of those samples that you collected?
Nothing formal. But one thing I can talk about is the species that we caught that were not caught in the 70s. And one thing that jumped out at me is that we were catching walleye pollock. And those fish had not been found in the area in the 70s. And as far as we know, our observations are the most northerly record of pollock. They have basically hadn't been caught in the Arctic before. So that was a surprise to me. I'd actually been telling people before I left that, I seriously doubt we'll catch any pollock way up there. And we did catch some. Similarly, Pacific cod. We caught a few Pacific cod, and those hadn't been known to be that far north before. So that was pretty exciting.
Were there other surprises or?
Another surprise is, was a surprise to me, and was that we had one really big toe of Opelio crab, and you know, that's a really valuable commercial fishery in the Bering Sea, and that's another one I wasn't expecting to be up there. Turns out, although they hadn't been caught in the 70s, I talked to a crab biologist the other day here at work, and he said, well, he wasn't too surprised that there were Opelio crab in the Arctic, but I certainly wasn't expecting them. I think the other big surprise, and it might be, I don't know how interesting this would be to the general public, but it was really interesting and challenging to us, was we're doing bottom trawls, so you know, trawls that go right along the bottom to catch fish and invertebrates, and the bottom was sort of a composition I hadn't really encountered in any other area in Alaska, and it was very challenging to work with our nets on that bottom. It was alternatively extremely muddy and clayey, like a really thick, heavy mud or clay, or like a boulder patch. And so we had a few toes where we came up with nothing but a bag of rocks, or we'd move a little further and come up with nothing but a bag of mud, and that's something I'd never seen before.
Elizabeth Lagerwell is a fisheries biologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is asking North Slope residents to be on the lookout for walrus hauling out on shore. At this time last year, as many as 6,000 walrus crowded along Alaska's Chukchi Sea coast when they ran out of ice to forage from. Joe Garlick Miller is a walrus biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage. He says the sea ice this year has lingered around longer, but there isn't much left.
So there's a lot of open water conditions there. Projections are that, you know, it may be very similar to the 2007 ice minima that occurred last fall. And we still have a few weeks until the end of the melt season before things start turning around. So we're keeping our eye on that.
There haven't been any reports of large walrus haulouts on the North Slope so far. Garlick Miller says there's still probably enough scattered ice floes for the animals to feed from, but he says if walrus do come to shore, they need plenty of space.
When they come to shore, they're usually quite tired. They don't generally swim indefinitely out in the ocean. They have to come haul out either on ice or, in some cases, on land to rest so they can replenish their energy to go out and feed again. And we're just asking for people's help and cooperation in letting them get the rest they need and try to give wide berth to any of the haulouts that may form.
Garlick Miller is also asking pilots and mariners to be respectful of any haulouts they encounter. Female walrus spend their summers in the Chukchi Sea. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Mike Mason in Homer, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Profit is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.